The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, welcome to another edition of the Russian Orthodox Medievalist. We are a Russian nationalist radio show, and I am a Russian nationalist myself, although not of Russian ethnic background. But we do show the highest respect to the other Slavic peoples, Serbs and Ukrainians and Belarusians, of course, as well as the Greeks, a non-Slavic people. So we are both a Russian nationalist and an Orthodox program, and we seek to bring that kind of mentality and that kind of understanding to a Western audience, and specifically with the concept of showing how the Slavic world, with Russia at its head, de facto head anyway, is really at the center of the battle against the New World Order. This is very much my life's work. And I really want my listeners and readers to take this very seriously. And today we're going to do a few things. The first thing I want to deal with is a contemporary issue, something that isn't very well known, and that is the defense ministry of both Russia and Belarus. They have a high level of cooperation, and the defense ministry of both of those countries is very much dedicated, even more so than the executive branch as a whole, to doing battle with the New World Order, in their case, literally doing battle with the New World Order. So, let's talk about Russia first. The head of the Russian Defense Ministry is a civilian. One of the differences between Russia and the United States is that the Slavic world often has uniformed officers having defense positions within the government, where, of course, that's pretty much out of the question in the United States. But in the Russian case, there is Serdyukov, Anatoly Serdyukov, who is a civilian, who is the head of the defense ministry right now. He is a former tax employee. He is a lifelong government worker specializing in tax questions, and I think it's kind of interesting that the head of the defense ministry is somebody who is a tax specialist, and that actually says several things. It says, number one, there is a very pressing question of financing and financing the military apparatus, as well as being the last line of defense in terms of tax collections. Now, one of the big battles between Putin and the oligarchs has been the oligarchs' belief that they are above the law and that they don't have to pay taxes. And so it's really not an accident that one of the big names in the tax ministry, or in the defense ministry, essentially a finance specialist. Now, a military man, Nikolai Makarov, is actually the military head, and that is the chief of the general staff. And it's also not an accident that this man, General Makarov, is a specialist in Siberia. He's the head of the Siberian army. And I think that says a lot. It says a lot concerning the Russian defense ministry's war against the New World Order. First of all, Siberia is one of the potentially wealthiest places in the world, sitting on trillions of dollars of oil and natural gas and every kind of precious stone and mineral you could think of. So that's one thing. The second thing is, of course, it has a huge, over 1,000 miles worth of borderland with China. And this is both a defensive mechanism, but in more recent times, it's actually an offensive mechanism, for the simple reason that Russian and Chinese cooperation in the military realm has been substantial over the last decade. And the purpose of that is to challenge the American, the EU, and NATO's domination of the military forces of the world. And so having General Makarov, number one, chief of the general staff, but having him, having the chief of the general staff being the head of the Siberian military district is also extremely important. But even, you know, down this hierarchy of authority, the first deputy minister, the state secretary, and then underneath him is the deputy minister for finance, a guy by the name of Kudlina, who is also kind of sort of the liaison with the regular Ministry of Finance in Russia, who is an anti-terror specialist. So here in the Russian military structure at the highest levels, you have the head of the defense ministry as a tax employee, and then you have a military department dedicated strictly for finance run by a man whose specialty is anti-terrorism. So the interesting thing is that you have this bureaucratic concept where the ability to raise money and the ability to use force to get taxes, particularly out of the elite, are intermixed and intermingled. And that is not an accident. So that's the basic structure of the Russian Defense Ministry. Now, the Defense Ministry has come out with an article. It's a few years old now, but it's still very much in force. I don't know if it exists in English. It's called the Insight of Defense, or the Defense Insight and Development, which lays out the basic strategy and the basic organizational principles of the Russian Defense Ministry and the Russian Armed Forces in general. And the very first thing on the list is deterrence. To have a force so strong and so powerful, this includes nuclear weapons, this includes naval and air institutions, that any kind of attack on Russian territory is simply out of the question. And you got to remember, when there was a chance of John McCain being president, openly calling for war against Belarus and to a great extent against Russia and Central Asia, it's not crazy to think that a man, an unbalanced individual, like John McCain, would not have considered serious military action against Russia via Belarus. He was not exactly, shy about talking, in these terms. So, you know, you have John McCain, as a, you know, married a major organized crime figure in, Arizona, very much connected to the Jewish oligarchy in Russia, and threatening Belarus and Russia on almost a daily basis, that the Russian Defense Ministry is really going to be concerned about the possibility of an attack on its territory, whether it be through the Islamic movement of Central Asia, the United States or its proxies, including the Georgians, which, of course, a year ago very much occurred, as well as very possibly by China under different circumstances, although I don't see the Chinese being a threat. The Chinese are, generally speaking, an ally of the Russian Federation. So you want to remember, this stuff isn't insane when you have people like John McCain saying what he's saying, and there's still a substantial portion of the neocon movement that speaks of military action against Belarus, against Russia, possibly against Kazakhstan and even China over the Taiwan issue. So this isn't, you know, crazy stuff. So the first thing that the Defense Ministry puts out there for the world to see is that our primary concern is with deterrence. And it's almost as if they're looking at John McCain and pointing at him and saying, deterrence. It will not be worth your while to attempt to do anything against the Russian Federation. But the second thing is combat readiness. That the Russian force, and this is actually the third thing, is mobility. There is a general move away in military doctrine, classic 20th century, against classic 20th century kind of warfare. Combat readiness is essentially combat mobility. The ability of the Russian Federation to be able to field armies and support personnel on different fronts at the same time and can shift them around very quickly. This is something absolutely central to the Russian Defense Ministry and their basic sense of what it is to defend this huge country. But furthermore, that also requires up-to-date equipment. This has something to do with why you have so many people in the Russian Defense Ministry hierarchy who have this economic background, this financial background. It's not an accident. Up-to-date equipment is something that employs the Russian scientific establishment to a great extent and is a way, you know, it has been a substantial way for the Russian Federation, particularly in the 1990s, to earn hard currency. It's not a problem anymore, but the sale of weapons to China, to India, India is one of Russia's big partners, and the Middle East, particularly Syria, and prior to recent years, Iraq, has been major recipients of Soviet or now Russian military equipment. So it's sort of a big deal that their equipment be up to date, not just for domestic use, defense uses, but for their foreign relations. And the sale of weapons itself, we should realize, is something very central to Russian foreign policy. So the regular sale of fairly high-tech weapons to China, India, Syria, Iraq at one time, and now Iran, you need to realize, is very, very central in the battle against the New World Order, because these are states that stand against the creations of the American government and of the Western Europeans in general. So India stands against the American allied Pakistan. Iraq, Iran, and Syria stand against Israel. And China is very much this bulwark against American economic and hence military expansion in East Asia. This is very good. This is very good for Americans to finally realize that the era of American military adventurism is over, and it's time for a multipolar world, which has been the political claim of the Russian and Belarusian governments and is a central claim of their defense ministries. Weapons sales and weapons training and, you know, the spare parts and everything necessary to maintain a Russian-supplied air force and navy and land forces is part of a cohesive anti-NWO foreign policy. And this needs to be taken really seriously by people who want to see the NWO brought down. So the war on terror, from the Russian point of view, is very different from the American point of view, at least where you have a situation where you do have terror cells financed by forces all over the world right on Russia's border, where you have various terror movements, both Islamic and some allied with the State of Israel, in Georgia, in the Punsky Gorge in Georgia, which is a major drug trafficking pipeline. Pipeline for weapons to terror cells in the Israeli government is deep into Georgian politics, which is why it was so important for Russia to teach Georgia a lesson, which really was teaching Israel a lesson, because the Georgian army was led by an Israeli, and the Georgian Defense Ministry, at least up until Russia had their way with it, was led by an Israeli citizen. So this was a very serious matter. When I talk about terror and drugs and prostitution, I am talking about a certain Islamic terror cells, as well as terror cells connected to the State of Israel, to the CIA, to the United States, and to international drug and prostitution cartels, which also have deep ties to the CIA and Mossad. And one of the major pipelines of that traffic through the CIA-controlled northern Afghanistan, ultimately to get to Western Europe, was the Punsky Gorge in Georgia. So the Georgian state becomes very strategic for Russian defense, and it's not an accident that another major recipient of Russian weapons and training is a very close Russian ally of Armenia, also part of this Caucasus region, and the Russian army and defense ministry has been arming the Armenians against both the Islamic and Israeli-connected terror cells operating in Georgia. So this is a very serious matter, and Georgia is one of the means whereby Afghan heroin that had been destroyed by the Taliban had completely torched the Afghanistani poppy crop that upset the CIA, it upset George Soros, and these guys had to be taught a lesson. the CIA created this so-called Northern Alliance, and of course immediately poppy production came back to a great extent. And in fact, Scotland Yard in Great Britain says most of its heroin is now coming from northern Afghanistan, which, you know, there's no secret, is controlled by the CIA and its creature, the Northern Alliance. So you see how all of this stuff connects together. You think something like the Pansky Gorge and Georgia and the Russian Defense Ministry approach to it would be a strictly regional issue, but the fact of the matter is this is a major conduit of the very mentality of the New World Order and its sickness, and really its obsession with these kind of evils of drug running, prostitution, human trafficking, and their very close connection to Israel. So, and the United States. So when these things, so these things are major issues for the Russian Defense Ministry, and this is what they really mean by the war on terror. These all, as far as Russia is concerned, are terror cells that need to be dealt with extreme force if necessary. And that goes a long way to explaining the situation this time last year in Georgia. Now, unlike the American Defense Ministry, the Russian Defense Ministry also has an ideological foundation. And given the fact that the U.S. and NATO and allied groups and governments connected to international banks and bankers such as Soros and the Rothschild family in Great Britain. This is their New World Order, and Russia is responding vehemently to that. I want you guys to remember, particularly those of you who are skeptical of Russia's commitment to the battle against the New World Order, I want you guys to remember how very close the Rothschild family is to the Russian oligarchy. And this Rothschild attempt to dominate Russian oil through its proxies, such as British Petroleum, to a great extent The Economist of London, which is a publication to a great extent controlled by the Rothschild family, and really is the mouthpiece of the British banking establishment. They have sought to demonize Putin and Medvedev and their definition of the war on terror. So there's another document that exists out there called the Global Partnership, which is the ideological position paper of the Russian Defense Ministry, and it has a number of points. We've covered the very concept of military strategy. Now here is the mentality behind the strategy. First of all, the Russians, the Belarusians hold that the international order must be decentralized. It must be polycentric, and it must be democratic. In other words, governments and polities, and of course they're looking at places like Afghanistan and Iraq, cannot be imposed from above. They have to be brought from below, according to the popular will, according to the tradition of the people, not according to the demands of George Soros or British Petroleum. The Russian Defense Ministry also believes that it's necessary for the United Nations to approve any major military activity. This isn't so much a veneration of the UN or some belief that it's a legitimate global institution, but it is a way to use a Russian or a Chinese veto against U.S. or Israeli unilateralism abroad. So you have nationalist governments like in Moscow and in Minsk that talk about the UN quite a bit. Remember, it's used as a weapon against the U.S. and the Israelis, and the Chinese or the Russians or both can use their veto to challenge American imperialism. And American imperialism has been challenged by the Russians as they denounced the Israeli government in no uncertain terms in recent years, and they have denounced the American invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan in recent years as well. The third point is that the Russian military is used only for defense, and that Russian forces dedicated to combat readiness and mobility have to be really decreased to a minimum, where you have an elite force on land, sea, and in the air that can be used, highly mobile, be brought from one side of the country to another depending on emergencies. So these are defensive, not offensive mechanisms. The other thing that the Russian military seeks to do is to create sort of an international infrastructure to reach its goal of being a great power, of being a regional hegemon that will maintain the traditional forms of government in the areas that Russia has an interest in, Central Asia, the Caucasus, and Eastern Europe. This kind of great power interest has a lot to do with repelling the New World Order attempt to surround and thus isolate Russia from interfering in the New World Order's projects abroad. And again, one of the central issues is cooperation with whoever is willing to cooperate against the drug trafficking and prostitution coming in from Central Asia and the Middle East through the Caucasus, and that's affecting the Russian people and the peoples of Eastern Europe. And there's no doubt that the Russian ministry is aware of how important the Israelis are to protecting these movements. And then there's a sense that the United States can still be used as someone to cooperate with, although I think that mentality is disappearing, that the U.S. is too corrupt, it's too deeply involved in this stuff. And as a result of this, there is an agreement that the Russians have signed called the Shanghai Cooperative Organization, and that really is a movement to allying with the major powers in Asia who are seen as less corrupt than the United States. And the U.S. really is no longer a partner. The U.S. cannot be a partner. It is too deep into this global regime. And as a result, the Shanghai Agreement created a substantial amount of cooperation with the Chinese and the Burmese and others in Asia, the Malaysians, as a way to create an alternative bloc to U.S. Domination. And on November 21st of 08, the Russian President Medvedev made a speech where he really held that Asia, specifically East Asia, is now central in terms of Russian foreign policy. And this has been something that the Eurasianist movement in Russia that I'm highly sympathetic to has been dealing with for a long time. That the future of the world, the economy, is polycentricity, nationalism, regionalism, and it's Asian, ultimately, in its basis. And Russia should realize that at least it's partially an Asian country, geographically anyway, it's an Asian country. And given that the New World Order is largely American and European in origin, and is a criminal enterprise, that the main way of doing battle with this mentality, the way of doing battle with Zionism and the New World Order, is to ally with the Chinese, the Indians, and to assist in the development of countries like Kazakhstan and Burma. Remember, people forget that Burma is an oil-rich place, and this is why George Soros and the CIA are deeply involved in trying to overthrow the government of Burma. I have an article that's been translated a few years ago into Japanese. I don't know if it exists in English anywhere on the Burmese situation and how important Burma is in terms of oil, gas, natural resources, and how it's under a nationalist and socialist government run by the military, and how deep George Soros is, partially because Soros wants to be even deeper into the drug trade, and as he promotes the warlords in Burma who fight the government and are being financed by drugs, he is promoting the legalization of drugs in America. So those two pillars of George Soros's mentality strongly suggest that he wants drugs legal in America, and he'll be controlling the drug trade out of Southeast Asia. And it's something that the Burmese government has made very clear that George Soros is not welcome here, and that's why the so-called opposition leader, that woman Suen, was thrown in prison a few years ago, because it was found that she was receiving money from major drug barons in Burma. She was receiving money from George Soros, who wants to monopolize the Burmese drug trade and the drug trade out of Southeast Asia. And as a result, the Burmese government threw her in prison. George Soros and the CIA are working really hand in glove to get her released and to overthrow the military government of Burma. So you see, Burma has come under Chinese protection and indirectly Russian protection, partially for this reason. So you see how these different things all connect up and show the forces arrayed against the New World Order. And it's really not a bad thing. And we should support these regional and nationalist movements and what might be considered social nationalist movements from Moscow to Peking to Rangoon in Burma. And so all three of these states have come under attack from the New World Order for very similar reasons. But Medvedev also said in 08 that polycentrism and regionalism are the wave of the future, that the financial crisis that the world is suffering comes from American arrogance, comes from American wealth and its monopolization of wealth and money in the big banks, and how there's this huge imbalance of wealth and power in the world, and how that should change. So these things have been absolutely central in the mentality of the Russian defense ministry, and how extremely important the defense ministry of Russia is in doing battle with the New World Order and creating this international infrastructure in favor of nationalism, of social nationalism, and hopefully a greater distribution of the world's wealth, which right now, the majority of which is being held by a handful of bankers in the West. And this is something that is that needs to be fought. And so we might want to call this the social nationalist revolution against the New World Order. More about this when we come back.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, we're talking about kind of an odd topic today. We're dealing with the defense ministry of Russia and Belarus and their role, their structure, their mentality. And I bring them up because very few people know anything about it, and it's very important that these are some of the central institutions that we should be very proud of. These institutions they're the vanguard of the social nationalist revolution or counter-revolution against the New World Order. They stand for nationalism, they stand for regionalism, they stand for polycentricity. And both the Russian and Belarusian defense ministries are in full agreement on bringing about the social nationalist revolution and the battle against the New World Order. In Belarus, the head of the defense ministry is a social nationalist, a man by the name of it's Colonel General Leonid Maltsev, and he is the executive head of the department. And like you see in the Slavic countries, having uniformed officers in the executive cabinet is not at all strange, like it is from the West. You have a general staff that, because Belarus is, you know, exclusively a land and air establishment, dependent on, you know, overseas trade and pipelines, as it is a landlocked country, its land support is in charge of logistics, and the Air Corps is, to some extent, an appendage of the army. this might make more sense in a place like Belarus, which is much smaller, and yet really has a very intense interest in a high-tech specialization. Remember, Belarus in the Soviet era was, as well as Ukraine, was one of the one of the high-tech centers of the Soviet former Soviet military establishment. Armenia, eastern Ukraine, and Belarus was really that high-tech hub of the Soviet defense ministry. And you have a similar movement in Belarus that you have in Russia, that you know at the moment you have a conscript force. Everyone serves 2 years when they reach 18. Both in Russia and in Belarus, there's a move to have a contract force, to a move to have an elite, relatively small, yet highly mobile military force that can contain any number of threats and move from one place to another without any problem. You have a great degree of cooperation with the Russian Ministry of Defense, and the problems are very similar. Belarus, because it borders Poland and faces Western Europe and Central Europe, is really dedicated to the possibility of a land war, possibly over oil, possibly over the oil pipelines and natural gas coming into Western Europe. Again, this isn't the crazy thing to worry about. It wasn't that long ago where Germany, well, just really last year, Germany broke away from the rest of the European Union and made a separate deal with Russia and Belarus relative to oil and gas transit and the pipelines. Russia had a spat with the European Union. Russia threatened to cut off supplies, and Germany cut away from the EU and made its own deal with Russia that ensured its supply. And this is something that upset the French and upset the United States very much, because this isn't supposed to happen. Russia is the enemy, according to the United States. And Germany, in cutting away from the EU and making a separate deal with Russia over the agreed-on price of oil and gas, said that Germany is going to do what's in its national interest in this regard, and not necessarily take orders from Belgium and from Brussels in that regard. So between 2000 and 2002, you have a basic military doctrine developing in Belarus, really concerned about these problems. As the financial crisis gets deeper, and as the system is more exposed as being illegitimate and oligarchical, which it is, the possibility for a war with Russia and Belarus over oil and gas and other things is not insane, particularly given the aggressive stance that the American neoconservatives, I mentioned John McCain and his threats against Belarus, his declaration of war against Belarus, had he become president, a serious shooting war with Belarus and Russia would not have been out of the cards as far as McCain is concerned. And he made no secret about that. So Belarus is concerned about guarding the pipelines. They're concerned about the possibility of false flag operations coming from Israel and the CIA, the possibility of blowing up the pipelines, of attacking refineries in Belarus, and oil refining is one of Belarus's technical specialties, which is why Belarusian connections with Iran, Syria, and Vietnam have been extremely important to the country, because although Belarus is very small, it has a great level of specialization, really inherited from the Soviet era, in oil refining. And so their mastery of this strategic area is very important to the Third World. And so you have substantial Belarusian investment as we speak in those three countries in particular, and also in Nigeria. So you look at the Slavic social nationalist revolution, counter-revolution, is building this infrastructure. And, you know, this may seem a very academic discussion, but this is absolutely a gun pointed at the temple of the New World Order. That these countries, as tiny as Belarus is, building a oil refining and high-tech military infrastructure with places like China and Burma and Vietnam and Kazakhstan and Armenia and Iran, And Iran, I think, really has been a major recipient of Belarusian money and Belarusian technical expertise in this respect. That can't be ignored. We're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars a year in terms of economic potential, completely outside of the mentality of the New World Order. And you know, in the case of people like Alexander Lukashenko, as well as General Leonid Maltsev, the head of the defense ministry in Belarus, this is something that is explicitly done to attack the interests of the Rothschild dynasty, which controls British Petroleum and to some extent Royal Dutch Shell. And this is why politicians in Europe and in America who receive money from the big oil firms, and John McCain was one of these people, Congressman Chris Smith from New Jersey is another one, the major neocon senators and congressmen and politicians throughout America and Europe who receive oil money are usually the most vehemently opposed to this movement of the social nationalist rebellion of the Slavic states, Belarus and Russia in particular, building this anti-Western, anti-Rothschild, anti-New World Order infrastructure militarily and in terms of energy policy with places like Nigeria and Iran. This explains the violent temper tantrums that John McCain has thrown in his office and even on the streets of D.C., or at least according to his staffers that I've interviewed in the past. This is the cause of his desire to launch a nuclear strike on Belarus and Russia. And it was John McCain that said that it's very possible that a nuclear strike might be considered in terms of Iran. It wasn't that long ago that McCain made these claims. So, again, Belarus seems like this little tiny country in the middle of nowhere, but its technical expertise, its a nationalist president, its open support of the social nationalist revolution and the infrastructure that it's building throughout the world in military personnel and in technique, as well as in oil and natural gas refining and in the high tech materials needed to successfully bring all of that stuff up to the surface and transport it throughout the world. This is frightening the West. This explains John McCain's attack on these countries, his threats against these countries, how the neocon establishment under George Bush put sanctions on Belarus the same time it put sanctions on Iran. These are not minor issues. These are central issues, and there are reasons to be happy. There are reasons to cheer on these people as they do battle with the New World Order, with the Rothschild family, with the CIA, and they're doing well financially. Alexander Lukashenko, as president of Belarus, has approval ratings over 80%. He has almost no unemployment in Belarus right now. The economy is growing by 10% a year, even in the midst of this crisis, because it's building bridges away from the West, which, as we see financially, the capitalist system is beginning to implode, and we can only cheer about that. But the Belarusian military doctrine, the concept behind the Belarusian military ministry and the defense ministry, really has 3 points. And these 3 points have all been decided on really over, since 2000. And the military doctrine was approved in 2002. Balanced cooperation. In other words, we're not against cooperating with the West, but don't you dare condemn us when we cooperate with the Iranian military or the Chinese military. We're an independent country. We will do what's in our interest to do, no different than the Israelis do or that Washington, D.C. does. So it's about balanced cooperation. Anybody who shows goodwill to Belarus will be shown goodwill in return. That's been the case with Armenia and Kazakhstan and Iran and China. These are the world's hotspots. These are the world's strategic crossroads. These are central places in the development of the infrastructure to fight the New World Order. Belarus voluntarily gave up its nuclear weapons. This is something that occurred after the Soviet pullout of Belarus in the early 90s. The Belarusians did not want nuclear weapons, did not want a nuclear showdown with anybody, and like Ukraine at the time, did not necessarily have the infrastructure to take care of these nuclear weapons, which is actually a big concern. You need a very large bureaucratic infrastructure in the country to maintain and care for a nuclear arsenal. And a similar to that, there is a doctrine of equality and equity with other states in the world. The Belarusian military will not favor one country over another, one region over another, one people over another. The idea is that the ideal world order is a world of self-determining national states, self-determining regions with their own currencies and ways of life, independent, without a single country or people or institution that seeks to rule. Now, the days of empire are over, and both in Russia and in Belarus you have this as an explicit doctrine of the military forces. The age of empire is over. And it's not an accident that over the last couple of years, relations between Minsk and Moscow have deteriorated. You know, Belarus is a fiercely independent country, a social nationalist a government that will not be ruled by anybody. And Belarus will do battle with anybody who seeks to trample on their independence. And if Russia gets too uppity in their relations with Minsk, Lukashenko will then go to China, will then go to Iran, continuously balancing off the larger powers that are in its sphere of influence. This is the nature of the social nationalist movement, both in Minsk and in Moscow. But just because Russia is so much larger and contains all of these reserves of oil and natural gas, the age of empire is over. That doesn't give you the right to dominate us or to dominate anybody else. Russians stay in Russia, Belarusians stay in Belarus, Chinese stay in China, Germans stay in Germany. This is justice. This is how the world order should be. And this is what independence is based on. The cultural community, the cultural similarities and language and religion of a people. Belarus will cooperate with anybody who holds that basic point of view. If you treat us as an equal, we will do everything in our power to share our expertise in terms of weaponry, in terms of high-tech guidance systems and missile delivery systems, as well as our particular specialty, oil and natural gas transport and oil refining. And you can't get more strategic than that in this international environment. The Belarusian military doctrine is based on those three points. There are 6 points where the Belarusian military forces can be used either internally or internationally. Number one, if there is a lack of effective political mechanisms, if there is no other way to resolve a conflict institutionally, then military power can be used. On occasion, it's the case that Lukashenko looks to the UN for justice if the U.S. it gets too uppity, or even if the Russians get too uppity in their relations with the country. But without these kind of political mechanisms, their military force has to fill that gap. Significantly, the second point, the second time where military force can be used, economic imperialism. If one country is using its economic force against the interests of Belarusian independence, military force can be used to stop that. Number three, the domination of a few powers. Right, this is directly coming from the defense ministry here. A world order dominated by a few empires is unjust. They could be Russian, they could be Chinese, they could be American, they could be Rothschild. It doesn't make any difference. Empire is evil, empire is wrong. If anything, the Belarusian Defense Ministry will use force and go to their deaths to defend the concept of nationalism as opposed to internationalism, as opposed to empire, as opposed to the world order of dominant capitalism which rules today. The excessive use of propaganda against the people. If legitimate modes of communication are shut down, military force can be used to open them back up again. The use of new technologies Now, it's been claimed, the Belarusian Defense Ministry claims, that non-nuclear weapons of mass destruction were used by the United States against the Iraqi forces over the last 15 years, particularly under the Bush administration. Sound weapons, the use of depleted uranium, phosphorus shells, which were used by the Israelis in Gaza. These technologies are illegitimate on the battlefield, and if there's any threat to use them on the Belarusian population, the Belarusian military has a right to respond in any way it seems necessary. And in addition to this, lastly, ethnic extremism. The idea of using a minority within the population to destabilize the government. That is a direct warning to NATO. The Belarusian Defense Ministry says if you're going to use the Polish population in Western Europe to attempt to destabilize Belarus, we will use military force against them. And that has been a way that the New World Order has been able to try to shake the Belarusian state by using the Polish minority in Western Belarus, which borders Poland, as a way to destabilize the government. So those are the six variables that the Belarusian Defense Ministry will use in deciding whether or not military force is morally justified. Those are the six reasons that justify the use of military force. So, we've covered the mentality of the Russian and Belarusian defense ministries with a specific concept that these ministries are armed and are using force against the New World Order, against the Rothschilds, against Big Oil, and are doing what they can to maintain the social nationalist movement throughout the world. So this has been The Orthodox Medievalist. This is Matt Johnson. I want to thank everyone at the Voice of Reason for allowing me to do this. We are a Russian nationalist, and we will maintain the social nationalist mentality. And this is what we are dedicated to against the New World Order. And I want to bid everyone, thank everyone for listening, for tuning in, and I'll hear from you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.